Who can say where the killer roams? When the blood flows, it's slaying time. Slay away. Slay away. Slay away.
To Slay Away, the podcast where we discuss the inspiration behind your favorite horror films, lore, gore, and every kill in between. I'm your host, E.L. King. In this episode, I'm reviewing one of my all-time favorite horror films and creature features, The Thing, with a special guest, my brother and fellow horror fan, Staker. Staker, welcome to Slay Away. How's it going? Nice to have you here. This is fun.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting.
I feel like we watched this together as kids, but don't quote me on that.
I think so. I mean, it was definitely, like I said, it had been a while, so there's only certain parts of this I could remember before watching it again.
Mayday. Mayday.
Discovered something. For 100,000 years, it was buried in the snow and ice. Now it has found a place to live. Inside. Where no one can see it. Or hear it. Or feel it.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to. But it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, and it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's one.
You guys gonna listen to Gary? He can beat one of those things!
Directed by John Carpenter, and the screenplay was written by Bill Lancaster, and the film was actually released on June 25th in 1982. The plot, of course, is that we're in remote Antarctica, and a group of American research scientists are disturbed at their base camp by a helicopter that's shooting at a sled dog. When they take in the dog, it brutally attacks both human beings and canines in the camp, and they discover that the beast can assume the shape of its victims. Our resourceful helicopter pilot, played by Kurt Russell, and the camp doctor, Richard Desart, lead the camp crew in a desperate, gory battle against the vicious creature as it attempts to pick them off one by one. So, did you know that The Thing, 1982, it's often referred to as a remake, but it's really not a remake because it was originally a book. So, The Thing from Another World, directed by Howard Hawks, was released in 1951. And all of, both of the films are based on a science fiction novel, Who Goes There, that was written by John W. Campbell. So I didn't read the book, but I did actually watch the film from 1951, and it's really good. So I would recommend it. You can find it on YouTube. And that's where I bought it and watched it. And it's a great film, and it has a lot of similar premises, but the films are very different.
Right. That would be interesting to see. I think as you bring in when you're mentioning the intro to the movie, I'm kind of curious what your take is on the intro of the movie when the helicopter is just chasing the sled dog and shooting nonstop. And then at one point they finally get to the American outpost, and you've got a Norwegian that pops out of the helicopter and just starts shooting right towards that group of guys standing outside.
Oh yeah, my take on it. I'll definitely get into that for sure, because I've got like a whole play-by-play of the scenes to get into. But first, I did want to say that back in 1997, Carpenter had told Empire Magazine that you'll never ever see anything like The Thing again, which I thought was really interesting, because then obviously in 2011, they did the prequel. Like, he wasn't involved in it, but they made the prequel. And we all know that the prequel is basically what happened at the Norwegian base before the sled dog gets chased over to the American base. And the 2011, the prequel, it was very hardcore about sticking to continuity and making sure that its continuity with the original film was super consistent, because at the end of the prequel, the sled dog escapes and the Norwegians jump in the helicopter to chase it. And then that's how the first film starts. So I thought that was pretty cool. So if you haven't seen the prequel in a while, rewatch it and then like look out for the different parts of continuity, because it's kind of interesting. But one thing that I wanted to ask the audience is, do you think that we finally have seen something like The Thing again? And be sure to send us your thoughts and feedback. Email us at slayawayradio@gmail.com, or you can send me a note on Twitter at slayawayradio. I would absolutely love that. But I do want to jump into some interesting, you know, backstory and talking about the reception of the film. So, The Thing was released, like I said, in 1982, before the explosion of digital filmmaking. So its super iconic combination of horror and science fiction is often considered a landmark achievement by famed horror director John Carpenter. So, like, obviously, working with Rob Bottin, the special effects and everything in the film are amazing. And I think Bottin was like 22 at the time. So
yeah.
Everything that he did for that film is really, really cool. But it's funny, because one reviewer, when I was doing research for this, his name was Alan Spencer, and he was a writer for Starlog magazine at the time that The Thing was released. And he had this to say about the film. So this is what he said. These are like direct quotes. He said, "It smells pretty bad, has no pace, sloppy continuity, zero humor, bland characters, and it's totally devoid of warmth or humanity." And then Spencer went on to say that the director would be better suited to directing traffic accidents.
Oh, wow.
I was like, whoa. Okay. So I had no idea what Starlog magazine was, so I had to look it up, of course. Apparently, it was a monthly science fiction magazine that was created in 1976, and it focused primarily on Star Trek when it first came out. And I'm not a Trekkie, so I'm not surprised that I'd never heard of it. But the final issue date was in like April 2009, so c'est la vie. It lasted for a while. But I was just like, wow, like this, when the film came out, it had a really harsh reception. So while The Thing is now considered to be a classic and a staple of the sci-fi like horror genre, at the time of its release, The Thing was met with an underwhelming box office performance and like just scathing reviews from critics. It was a total flop that became a horror classic that most horror fans will list at the top of their like all-time favorite movie lists, right? Like, it's definitely in my top 10.
You know, for me, after we rewatching it, I would say probably didn't make it. I would in some ways partially agree with the review you read to a point, because it really didn't like connect or pop off for me until about an hour in. And then that's when it got a little bit more. Because the pace of the movie isn't quick on getting to what you learn about the
Yeah, I mean, that's Carpenter, though. He's a master tension builder. He's very much like Wes Craven in that way. Like, it was all about really showing you these characters, but not giving you too much backstory and kind of coming into where they were and then like building some sort of tension. But if you watch it through a different lens, like the way I watched it this time, I was really watching for all of the little things that I maybe hadn't noticed on the first couple times where I'll just turn it on and I'm not paying super close attention. Definitely because I was also watching it with more of a reviewer's eye. But one other thing that happened with when the film came out is that the thing was released just 2 weeks after Steven Spielberg's E.T. So it kind of set it up to crash and burn at the box office by comparison, when you consider that both depict an alien visitor from another world, but it's in a vastly different scenario. So both play out our fears of that kind of creature, but E.T. kind of dismissing them and then the thing reinforcing them. You get some very different things going on. So if we jump into the movie kind of scene by scene, like what you had talked about, the film begins, you know, building tension right away from the opening credits, because it has this incredible like experimental synthwave score that was written by the legendary composer Ennio Morricone. Before we get a view of space as this like spaceship crash lands into Earth. What's interesting to me with that is that like this is like an accidental alien invasion. It's not. I'm not even sure. I don't know. I'm not even sure that the life form that is frozen on ice, like the life form mimicked the alien that's in the ice. Like, I think that the ship was attacked by this alien life form. The aliens were attacked by aliens and then the ship crashed. Like, it's a whole thing.
Because it got me thinking towards a completely different movie, but kind of like they had the thought of Predator, where they have all these different species on board, and it makes me wonder if it was necessarily those aliens or something else that got to those aliens.
Well, even if did you ever see the film Life? So it's set in space. It's a space crew. They find this life form in space, and they bring it on board, and they're kind of looking into it, and then all of a sudden, sorry if you've never seen Life, people, by the way, like, stop this right now. Stop this episode right now. Go watch the film Life. It's starring Ryan Reynolds and like Jake Gyllenhaal and some other people. And what happens is like the life form starts to sort of take shape a little bit, and then it literally like goes into Ryan Reynolds' body in his suit and like sucks all of the biological material out of him to where he just disapparates. It's like amazing. It's actually really good, so if you haven't seen it, check it out. So that's what it reminds me of. It's not in that case, it's not replicating people, but it is like destroying whatever it comes in contact with. And if it were to reach civilization, it would be devastating, right?
Yeah. That's, I think I was, we'll get to that, I'm sure. But that is one part in the movie where they mentioned the time frame that it would take before it just completely destroys humanity.
Yes. That's where Blair starts to go a little bit wackadoo. But so Antarctica, winter, 1982. A sled dog is chased by a helicopter pilot from the surviving Norwegian research facility team. There's like two people, and they fire on the dog as it heads towards the American Research Station, the National Science Institute Station 4, but apparently it's also called Outpost 30. It gets very confusing because there's lots of different signs with a lot of different numbers. I think it's, I don't know what it's called, honestly. It's the American Research Base, and that's all I need to know. So It's funny because the first kill of the movie you might actually miss if you're not paying close enough attention, because they're chasing, they're shooting at the dog. The funny thing is, I'm like, how can you miss shots that many times? Is it, like you said, I'm like, is it really that hard to, like, maybe you're just not a trained sharpshooter or something like that. You're flying way too low. This is very dangerous. You shouldn't be doing this. But we arrive at the American Research station with the researchers that are like gathered in the rec room, hanging out, playing ping pong or whatever. And then we cut to MacReady, played by Kurt Russell. So RJ MacReady, he's pouring himself a drink of J&B whiskey. Apparently that's his brand. And he's like trying to play a game of chess or whatever against the computer's AI and gets frustrated after he loses. And then he like pours his drink into the computer's wiring and calls the computer a cheating bitch or whatever. I'm just like, yeah. I'm like, man, like now you can never play chess again. What have you done? So, yeah. So like in pursuit of the dog, the Norwegian helicopter flies over the American research station and all the guys come outside to see what's happening. And MacReady and the other researchers like emerge and they see that it's circling the camp. So they don't know what's going on, but they know that it's like taking shots, right? So they don't know if the Norwegians are like attacking the Americans because I don't think they even see the dog at that point.
I think too, that you even yourself are questioning what the heck's going on there, because for some reason these Americans that are at this outpost, they're not scared at all at the fact there's a helicopter shooting all around them right now.
I have to say, like, even the people, maybe it's just me, I don't know what Antarctic researchers are supposed to look like, but even to me, like, nobody on the American base actually looks like a scientist. I don't know what that is. It's just like nobody looks like they're part of a research crew. Some of them are actually mechanics, apparently. Now RJ MacReady is a helicopter pilot, so he's not a scientist, but like two of them are doctors and like at least one of them's a scientist. Fuchs is a scientist. Fuchs, I think
I feel like he's the only one there. Well, maybe Bennings. Maybe Bennings, but
Bennings might be a scientist, but I don't know. Yeah. Never trust a ginger. I don't know. But anyway, so the Norwegians, like, the biggest twist, they start dropping grenades from the helicopter to catch the dog, which is like even crazier, and they're missing and stuff like that. So I just think this is a really spry dog. And then they land outside the American base camp and one of the Norwegians like runs out of the chopper and he starts to throw a grenade and then drops it. So blows himself and the helicopter up.
After
right.
Taking shots towards the dog where there are guys standing and happens to shoot one of them.
He shoots like, Bennings. Yeah, he shoots Bennings. So like at the same time, the dog runs over and like nuzzles up to Clark. He nuzzles up to Clark. Clark is like the dog kennel guy. So everyone like dives into the snow and the dog like runs off. The shooting's happening. Gary, you know, jumps out of he like smashes out the window and he like shoots the other Norwegian who's got the gun who shoots Bennings. He shoots that guy in the head. So there you go. We got two kills already. Like the Norwegians are dead. I remember apparently one of the Norwegians, if you would watch the prequels, it was Hans from the prequel. But like, it was Hans. So I don't know who the other guy was. So, but, that's what I found out. So, the American team rushes to investigate and they put the helicopter fire out and all that stuff. The dog comes inside. And then like the fire is extinguished and like MacReady's just like the first goddamn week of winter, you know? It's just like, okay. So it's kind of setting up the whole thing. Like, well, okay. Yeah. So it's the beginning of winter. You know, we're probably in a situation where temperatures are dropping, like something's going on. So we actually meet Copper, Dr. Copper, who is Richard Desart, and George. So George is Bennings. We'll just call him Bennings. So George Bennings. I don't know why they even gave him a first name, honestly.
Yeah, I was curious.
Because they just call him Bennings throughout the whole film.
Yeah.
But so he's played by Peter Maloney. And he's the one that gets shot in the leg. He doesn't really seem fazed by the fact that he gets shot, but Copper's stitching him up, and they muse over like why the chopper was flying so low and chasing and shooting at that dog. And Copper's like, cabin fever, who knows? And I was like, yeah, sure, it must be just those crazy Norwegians with their cabin fever. Yeah.
Do they mention at one point like how long they've already been out there? I don't know
if they do.
Because it just seems like there's not only, obviously, there's Norwegians in America. It just seems like it's set up to where
I think usually in different research-based scenarios, you're probably never out for more than like 8 to 3 months at a time. I don't think you can be out for more than 3 months at a time in those conditions, but don't quote me on that because I don't know. But we cut to Windows, whose hair is majestic and amazing. He's the one with the big curly hair and the sunglasses. So Thomas G. Waits, who plays Windows, he's calling McMurdo Base, which everyone should know because McMurdo is like the big base where all the different smaller bases can come together. So McMurdo is like one of the big main bases, I think, for maybe just the U.S. I think that's the U.S.'s like larger base. Is that right? I don't know if that's accurate.
Yeah, but they don't really go into it.
They're trying to report the incident, but they can't reach anyone. And apparently they haven't been able to reach anyone for like 2 weeks.
Yeah.
And like, here's Blair just sitting behind Windows, kind of like, you know, he's got like a cup of coffee or something. He's just watching what's happening. Blair is played by Wilford Brimley. And he's stressing to Windows the importance that they reach someone. And it's like, obviously, it's important that they reach someone. He's like, Windows is getting very frustrated and annoyed at Blair at this point. It's like, okay, Blair, yeah, I get it. Thanks, Blair. So Blair is a doctor of, like, I think, biology, where Copper is like a physician type doctor.
Yeah.
So there's like the two type of scientists. And then we meet Knowles, played by TK Carter, roller skating down the hallway of the base and stopping to exclaim to everyone in the rec room that maybe we're at war with Norway. So, and then they're covering up like the body of the dead Norwegian on the ping pong table or something like that. They use the ping pong table for the dead bodies a lot. But I think then there's other times throughout the film where then there's no bodies on the ping pong table and I don't know where they move them to. So I'm not really sure what's going on with that ping pong table.
They're definitely sturdier back then than they are now. I'll tell you that.
Oh, heck yeah. I was like, ping pong tables. I feel like there's at a point where I think there's like three bodies on the ping pong table. And I'm like, there's no way that that thing is actually holding up all that dead body weight. And then we meet Palmer, who's played by David Clennon. And he says, I was wondering when El Capitan was going to get a chance to use his gun to obviously Gary Sismay. And Gary is the one who had to shot the other Norwegian in the head.
Right.
And Gary is played by Donald Moffat. So, and I think he's actually a fairly well-known actor. So the crew discusses at that point kind of the situation and talking about the Norwegians and, you know, that they'd only been at their base for like 8 weeks or something like that. That's why I think that maybe it's standard for it to be like maybe 3 months or longer. I'm not sure, but they say it's not enough time for them to have gone bonkers, basically. So, Copper, who's concerned about the safety of the rest of the Norwegian base, recommends that they go over to the base to like check on the Norwegians. So at that point, MacReady and a few others go to investigate the burned out helicopter to find like that it's been loaded with like 15 cans of kerosene. For whatever, I was like, 15 cans. I don't know why they needed 15 cans. And I'm not even sure what they were going to burn. Cause like, was it for the dog? Was it for something else? I'm not really sure. But Gary, Copper, and MacReady all, I think, fly over to the Norwegian base together. And apparently there's a winter whiteout storm coming. So like it'll shut down flights and everything like that. So there's like a really short window of opportunity for them to do this. So they have to like hurry up. Mm-hmm. But what was interesting to me is that back inside, like Nalls is watching them and they're just he's like talking to Palmer and some different stuff. But as Palmer's like walking away, there's the kind of very ominous theme starts to play. And you can see the dog just like watching everybody and yep. waiting as it lays under the ping pong table. Here we again with the ping pong table. And then we see Mac and the crew like take over in the helicopter and to like head towards the Norwegian base. So I was like, there's a lot. This time when I watched it, I watched the dog a lot more. I watched everywhere the dog went. So George is running down the hallway in his pajamas.
Right.
And he's like pounding on the door. Oh, yeah. He wants Nalls to turn the radio down because Very Superstitious by Stevie Wonder is playing really loud.
Fantastic song. Yeah.
Yeah. Very superstitious. Yeah. And Bennings is just like, I'm trying to sleep. You know, I was shot today. Yeah. You just like turn the fucking music down. And then we pan across the kitchen to the empty medical bay. And then we cut to the empty rec room. And finally, down the hallway, we see the sled dog emerge.
This was the first moment that kind of creeped me out a little bit.
Yeah.
Because as the dog's coming out, at first I was like, because I was trying to, you know, the practical effects in this movie are just crazy. Like, yeah, just completely crazy. I was like, is that actually the dog right now? Because I couldn't remember the scene. And I thought maybe something crazy, like big, was going to happen. But just the dog coming out of that doorway, I don't know. There was something about that that just kind of was super eerie to me.
It is eerie. And it just slinks down the hallway into an open doorway where a member of the camp is waiting inside. And we only see the silhouette of somebody in the room. We don't know who it is. Mm-hmm. And Carpenter actually used a double for the scene intentionally so that the audience wouldn't be able to guess who the silhouette was. They didn't want you to guess who. They wanted you to have to kind of like think who's the infected character.
Right.
So there's a lot of theories about who was infected first, and there's two potential scenarios for who got infected first. Hmm. So one thing is, whose room did the dog come out of? That's number one.
Right.
Because he does come out of a door and then go into another door. So there's a couple possibilities here. And while I was initially thinking, oh, well, he's just slinking out of this door and whoever's room he went into is the first one that got infected, now I'm having some second thoughts and I'll walk you through assimilation a little bit later. So because I've got some, I've gone down a theory list. I've been doing my research. There's a lot of rabbit holes to go down. So Mac and Copper and Gary, once they're over at the Norwegian base, they find that it's been like totally demolished. And it's still on fire at that point. And they go inside, they investigate, they find a bunch of dead bodies at the camp. There's a Norwegian inside who's like frozen. He's having like killed himself with a straight razor. It's very graphic. I actually counted that kill. So we'll call it kill number three.
Sure.
And then Copper exclaims, "My God, what the hell happened here?" It's like, well, you wait, Copper. Mac and Copper, they go deeper in the base and they find this like portable video unit and a bunch of research notes in the lab. And Mac like investigates a couple of the other rooms and stuff like that. They go in the storage shed. And then this is where they find the block of ice that once contained the alien creature that's like hollowed out with some like exceptionally terrifying string music playing in the background. So this is interesting because you'll recognize this scene from the prequel. It's like the continuity is amazing. So if you go back and like you watch The Thing and then you watch the prequel, you look out for those different spots of continuity. It's pretty good.
Yeah, I'm going to have to go back and watch.
Yeah, now that you've rewatched the first one, watch the 2011 one. It's pretty interesting. Yeah. They say something about like maybe they found a fossil or something like that, and then Mac sees something, some smoke coming off of some kind of like burned carcass or whatever. They go to investigate. They find all these like cans of kerosene, and Copper goes in for a closer look and asks, "Is that a man in there?" And Copper's like, whatever it is, they burned it up in a hurry. And Mac asks him to help like find a shovel. And I think that's because they're going to like pick it up with a shovel or something, or put it out with snow. And then they put it in the back of the chopper or whatever, because they do bring it back to the base for whatever reason.
Well, and it's just back to another part, too, where it's like no one's really seems all that concerned yet.
Yeah, what is this weird looking double human carcass thing? Let's bring it back to the base. Yeah, no problem. I'm like, no, you should just leave it there and call someone. Like, you know,
I've seen too many horror movies. I don't think that would be something I would do right there, is pick it up.
Well, I guess, though, like with them being researchers and stuff, right. It's like, well, of course we got to bring it back and investigate it. Yeah. So at this point, from the sled dog's point of view, out the window, we see Mac and Copper land back at the camp. And then the crew rushes out to help unload something from the helicopter as the dog is looking on. So I don't know how many people went out to help unload, but the dog is watching from the window. The carcass is like still steaming when they unsheath it on the lab slab or whatever by the crew. And everyone's like really horrified. And I'm like, how is it still steaming after being out in the cold and on the helicopter for all that time? It's very confusing. So somehow the carcass or the creature is also still super ooey gooey fresh after traveling in freezing conditions from one base to the other. So I think Copper is asking Blair to do an autopsy on the creature right away, which I was also like, why are you going to do an autopsy on it? Like, how would you don't even know what it is. So like, if you did an autopsy, like, how would you know?
Try to figure it out.
What's going on? Maybe. I don't know. But the crew is like looking on in disgust, and they're also like really fascinated at the same time, but maybe afraid of the unknown. And fear of the unknown is like a really important theme in this throughout the film, and that's, you know, part of the novel too, like with who goes there. The camera like pans across the creature's body and it closes in on the many faces and everything, which I thought was really scary when I was younger. And then Mac appears like really uncertain, like everybody else's, and we cut to the sled dog again watching from the doorway.
Yeah.
So it's like interesting. I was like, this fucking dog, if you watch for it, he's everywhere. But time passes because Windows is like passed out next to the ham radio. Gary sneaks up on him and like turns up the volume or something to scare him awake. And Windows screams and stuff like that. And Gary asks if he's reached anybody yet. And I remember I liked this part because Windows is like, reached anybody? We're 1,000 miles from nowhere, man. And it's going to get a hell of a lot worse before it gets any better. And it's like, yeah. Oh, man, I love the foreshadowing. Yeah, I was just like, if only you knew. it was great. But Copper finishes up the autopsy he actually does an autopsy on the Norwegian, the Gary shot, while Blair is like doing the autopsy on the creature. So he says that there's nothing physiologically wrong with the Norwegian that explains like his erratic behavior.
Right.
But chasing down the sled dog. So they don't know why he did this. And then Blair does the autopsy on the creature and finds that it has this normal set of internal organs that a human would have. So it's all very mysterious. And then night falls, which is where I think it gets really creepy. So.
Yeah, I think this is where the beginning of those like amazing effects they did kind of start coming in.
So night falls, we cut to Palmer and Childs. Childs, that we finally meet Childs. Childs was played by Keith David, who I love. I love the character of Childs. In their bunk watching VHS recordings of some kind of game show, and they're like smoking a joint. Windows, Bennings, and Clark. Clark is played by Richard Mazur. And then Vance Norris, who's played by Charles Hallahan, excuse me. Nalls and Fuchs. Fuchs is played by Joel Polis. They all hang out in the rec room and stuff. It's a lot of dudes. The sled dog is, he like startles Bennings, and then he asks Clark to put the dog in with the other dogs in the cages outside. So Clark walks the sled dog out to the cages and lets him in with the other dogs. So the dog walks very slowly and taking a seat in the center of the pen. And, Clark shuts off the lights and walks away. And this is when shit gets real. So, because we start to hear, we start to hear this deep, labored breathing, and the other dogs begin to growl as the unknown sled dog starts to like shake and change shape, and its head explodes into some kind of like flower-like mouth. Fleshy tentacles come out of its body, along with spider-like legs. And we watch as one dog tries to escape, but it's splashed with some kind of liquid. Which I'm like, is this how you digest it, or like what is happening? I don't know what it is. I think it's like a gestation type of liquid or something. It's gross. It's very slimy. It looks to me, it looks like cream soup of some kind, which I wouldn't put past Botten at all. And so Clark hears the noises and the dogs barking and everything. So he walks back in the room because this literally happens like seconds after he puts the dog in the cage. And he tries to turn the light back on, but the switch isn't working. And I'm like, well, how the fuck did this dog? He's got telekinetic powers. Now the lights don't work. So it's weird. So at that point, I think you're like, okay, so someone has been assimilated because these lights won't turn back on. There's no way that the dog did it.
You know, that's actually an interesting thought, because I didn't think about that when that was happening.
I didn't think about it till right now. I'm going to tell you that much. Yeah. I was like, well, somebody had to have made sure that the lights wouldn't turn back on so that this could happen.
It had to be that at that point already that dog, some form of particle got with somebody else and then began to take over.
Yeah. And there's like totally two possible suspects in that scenario. Clark opens the pen door and one of the dogs jumps out and knocks Clark over onto the ground, and he turns and he sees the tentacles flying all over the pen, and he shuts and locks the pen and is like trying to keep it from getting out. He's just looking at it in disbelief. He doesn't scream.
Not freaking out.
Or anything like that.
It's another Saturday. It's more of that in this movie where you're kind of like, everybody's pretty chill about what's going on right now.
You'd think they'd all seen monsters before.
I guess they've seen some stuff when they're in Antarctica.
But like, we cut to Mac. He's like walking into the kitchen to grab a beer, but he overhears that horrible noise and the dogs from the other room. So Mac immediately makes a run for the fire alarm. He pulls it to alert the crew that something distressing is going on. And the alarm sounds. We see Mac and Gary and some of the others near the pen. And then Mac is like obviously carrying a gun. And Clark says, I don't know what the hell's in there, but it's weird and pissed off, whatever it is. I was like, I guess it's the 80s. I don't know. So Mac tells Bennings to go get Childs we see everybody scrambling around the hallway in their underwear and pajamas and stuff. So Bennings finds Childs and tells him that Mac wants the flamethrower, which I don't remember him asking for it, but like, yeah, get the flamethrower. So so here's something really interesting. So this is super interesting because in the 1951 film,
The Thing from Another World,
one of the key taglines was fire cannot kill it. So I guess that all we had to do was give it like 30 years. Because honestly, though, so Carpenter's take on this, it's more of a reimagining, like I said, than a verbatim remake of the original film adaptation of the book. So it's the 80s now and fire can kill it. So we're going to light fucking everything in this movie on fire. And we do. So, as Mac and Clark approach the dog pen, Palmer like flies into the room with an extinguisher and Mac gets up really close to the pen, and I think we hear this like really nasty gurgling and like barking noise. Because Mac opens up the cage door and like shines the flashlight in there to center on the pen, but he's finding like the dogs being absorbed into the single large, like bloody creature. And it's probably one of the coolest and most gruesome scenes to expose the crew to the alien with, think, like for the opening.
Just
and I think that it's maybe it's more impactful for us because it's animals and not people.
Yeah, because it also, when it pans back in there, like then you had the dog too that was covered in whatever the heck that was.
There's like the viscera, and then some of them like getting tied up in tentacles where it looks like they're being strangled. Because we hear all that like terrifying nails on a chalkboard, like visceral screaming coming from the creature. Yeah. And the crew's just looking on in horror and disbelief. Like literally they're just looking and staring and making like no sound. They're like just shocked. And then Mac and Gary just start fucking shooting it. And the dogs, to Clark's dismay, like he tries to stop them because Clark is like devoted to these animals. Mac pushes Clark back and like slams the cage door closed and all that good stuff. And the creature, he grows. They like watch him grow and absorb the bodies of the dogs. Childs walks in at that point with the flamethrower to save the day. So unfortunately, it's like too late. Two great like clawed arms emerge from the creature as it's attempting to pull itself up into the ceiling at that point. And the rest of the creature sits in the corner of the pen. It's like really nasty. So it's a mess of like eyes, blood, viscera, and then like this flower like pod emerges from the mouth made of dog tongues. And that's a really key detail that Bodden put in there. So he really outdid himself on the special effects for this film, so much so that he had to be hospitalized for exhaustion before the filming concluded. Wow. Because he
worked nonstop.
He did. Yeah. And he was like 22 years old or something like that at the time. So they actually brought in another another special effects person to replace him for the latter half of the film.
Because he
was recuperating.
Yeah, I think I read that it said that he worked 7 days a week for 56 weeks to do all that. That I was wow, especially to be so young too and come up with like some of the scenes that are in this. I mean, yes, it's an older film, and so you know it's not like some crazy. But I appreciate practical effects stuff. It's probably my favorite to see in a movie.
Well, that's one of the reasons that this is on my top 10 list, because I can go back to it and I'm still stunned by the effects every time. Yeah. Even when there's some scenes where I'm like, well, look at all this strawberry jelly.
Or an egg. You see a cracked egg. What point? I was just like, that's a yolk.
Yeah, exactly. Childs rushes in and burns the creature. And I think the others come in to like extinguish the flames and all that stuff. And then the camera, you know, pans over the crew, and still everyone's unable to kind of discern like what just happened in the darkness, because mostly it was dark. No one's really sure what they saw. And next thing we know, morning arrives. Blair is in the lab tearing the legs off of the bloody creature and performing another autopsy while Fuchs is assisting him. And he like cuts into the creature and he looks like he's ready to vomit.
Yeah.
So Blair is like explaining the organism to the crew. He says something like, you see, what we're talking about here is an organism that imitates other life forms, and it imitates them perfectly. When this thing attacked our dogs, it tried to digest them, absorb them, and then in the process, shape its own selves to imitate them. Yeah. Okay. So that's why I think that's like gestational type fluid.
Yeah.
Because if he's talking about digestion and stuff. So it was always a question for me whether or not the creature could imitate more than one creature at a time. But this statement from Blair appears to affirm that it can infect and mimic multiple organisms. So that's right. Why we could have multiple infected crew members at the same time.
Yeah. Later on in the film, you hear him talk about all it takes is just one particle,
like one drop of blood.
Yeah. So, yeah, it's why it gets so crazy after the 60 minute mark.
But let's see. I think it's funny because then we find like Clark and Blair in the pen. I guess some of the dogs survived. They didn't all get assimilated, but I thought they were all dead. So I was surprised by that.
Like the one that hopped out initially and knocked over.
Yeah, so one hopped out, but apparently there's like at least 3 to 4 of them alive.
Oh, yeah.
So Blair discovers that the infected sled dog was roaming freely around the camp all day. And then he begins to suspect that Clark might have been assimilated.
Yeah, which we
the guy he's like sitting there with. And then, of course, later we find out that Clark is human. And I think I mentioned this a couple times because MacReady shoots him in the head,
which it's funny, though, because when as you're watching the film, like taking into the fact that, you know,
they're trying to throw suspicion on a Clark like the whole time.
Yeah, the whole time.
So the two people throughout the film that they're trying to throw this like assimilation suspicion on are Gary and Clark. But yeah, so Blair is like starting to put together all the dots of how the creature assimilates and like the potential threat to civilization and all this kind of stuff. You almost kind of forget that they discovered an alien spacecraft.
Yeah, actually,
it's such a short moment in the film.
Watching it again, because I did not remember that at all when I rewatched it. I didn't remember that. Oh, well, yeah, that was the thing.
Because in the 1982 film, we only see the outside of the spacecraft. We never go inside.
Right.
But in the 2011 prequel, we spent a lot of time inside the spacecraft. So it's interesting. It's not. And I think that's because that spacecraft, that's not what this film is about.
Right.
It's like, more about
what the thing
that's
is.
Where the thing came from. But this is not about that. Yeah. It's really more about these people and their relationships and like us trying to see what happens with how they survive, the decisions they make, sometimes the poor decisions they make when put in these tense, stressful situations. And then the decisions they make when it comes to the survival of civilization. So
and that's what comes up next is that from Blair.
Yeah, and not just Blair, because then it becomes MacReady's, falls on his shoulders. So Mac actually heads out to that Norwegian dig site with Vance Norris in the helicopter. So at this point, I think it's Mac, Vance, and somebody else. So there's like a third crew member with them, but I have no idea who it is because they never.
When they go out to
the dig site.
And that's when they find like the big. Yeah. Because they find the ship and the big
block. Okay. So they go out. They do. So Mac and Norris discover the spaceship. They determine it's been in the ice for over like 100,000 years. So apparently that scene from the beginning of the movie was from a really long time ago. Mac, Norris, and an unknown third crew member find where the creature was unearthed from the ice by the Norwegians. And then Mac likely recognized the shape of the block of ice that was discovered because it's like a perfect cutout. I don't know who the third crew member is. You know, there's a third person because you see a third person standing there. Here's where I kind of want to jump a little bit ahead and talk about assimilation. There are a couple of theories about in what order the crew is assimilated. If you look at the silhouette of the person when the dog walks into the room, there's two possible crew members that it could be. It could be Palmer. Or it could be Vance Norris. Vance Norris is alone with Mac for an extended period of time on the alien spacecraft at this point, which is why a lot of people think that potentially at this point, Mac was infected. So that is a theory. That is like one theory that there is because there's a lot of people at the end that believe that Mac was a Mac thing. He was a thing. So at the end of the film. It's just a theory. So I just want to call that out because this is the only point at which I have found that Mac could have been infected.
Right.
Throughout the film. I have watched it like five times doing research. And Vance, I believe that Vance Norris was the first to be infected. Now, the only way for me that Palmer could have been infected first was if the dog came out of, you know, that doorway it came out of before it went into that room. Right. If Palmer was wherever the dog came from. So
because you don't know behind that.
Because like you don't know. Yeah, you have no idea. So in my mind then, OK, Palmer and Vance are both infected. And then I still don't know who that third fucking crew member is. that went on this little expedition to the dig site. Because you never know. You never
die from just being infected. Because in my take, Vance died from being infected after a point.
Well, that's like a copy of Vance. It's not even Vance, right? It's funny because Vance Thing died of a heart attack, which is boring. But I think he just like this, the assimilation wasn't going well or something like that. So, right. Because it's a perfect copy, maybe there was something with the original Vance's body that was wrong with his heart. Since it's a perfect copy, that would go that to reason be. That it copied the problems that Vance's body had. And so it caused that heart attack type situation.
Or there's that theory that he was one of the first ones. If he was one of the first ones to get infected, then maybe after a period of time, like you said, there could have been a complication with the assimilation where it didn't work out.
Back at base, Mac explains to Childs and the rest of the crew about the discovery of the spaceship while drinking his J&B whiskey.
He's always drinking.
And this is one of my favorite lines when Childs is like, I just cannot believe any of this voodoo bullshit.
Yeah.
And that's like one of my favorite lines. And Palmer just like jumps into the conversation, which I thought this was super weird because he's got his headphones on, but he's jumping into the conversation. So I'm like, excuse me, sir, how did you even hear them?
They ain't plugged in.
He wasn't really listening to anything. Like Palmer's been assimilated at this point. He's a thing. And he's just like being sneaky and suspicious. And he's like, it happens all the time, man. They're falling out of the sky like flies. Government knows all about it. Brian Mack, whatever. I was like, and Charles just keeps referring to everything as voodoo bullshit at this point. Despite the evidence that he saw with his own eyes of an alien, and Knowles rolls in, he asks like who tossed his dirty underpants into the kitchen trash can. This is an indicator that one of the crew has been assimilated by the thing. So here's the reason that I don't think that Palmer got assimilated first. Those are Palmer's dirty underpants.
Oh, okay.
It's never explicitly said that they're Palmer's dirty underpants, but like based on everything we know, I'm pretty sure they're Palmer's, like because he's the one that's wearing long johns.
Okay.
Under his like jean jacket thing. So because it can't assimilate clothes or whatever, I just assume like at some point in time, because we know that he's a thing because of later scenes that like those are his dirty drawers or whatever, because it's not actually underpants. Like it's not, he says underpants, but it's just a pair of long johns. So like big deal, guys. I think it's interesting because Childs wants to know, this is what he says. How does this motherfucker wake up after thousands of years on the ice? And Mac tries to explain his theory of not knowing and tells the crew to ask Blair. It's like everyone just refers to Blair and what Blair knows about everything.
They'll have a clue.
Yeah. So this is where this is the part of the film where shit starts to get interesting. This is your part. So where everything starts to happen. Blair using the power of 1982 technology and what looks like a video game figures out how our cells are assimilated by the thing. Imitating the original cells, the computer estimates that there is a 75% chance that one or more team members are infected and have already been assimilated. Blair then assesses how long it would take for the organism to infect the entire world population if it reached civilization, and it is obviously not a good prognosis. No, like it uses such a large number that I won't repeat it for you because I'm just like, okay.
I'll repeat it. It said 27,000 hours, which actually
27,000 hours.
If you think about that, that's not a long time.
You're better at math than me. You always have been. So I was just like, we'll let you take that one.
Yeah, it would be some time. But that would definitely not be a long time for civilization to be wiped out.
It would
and
be
you gotta think where it's going to go first as well. You know, if it were
from Antarctica, I have no idea.
Well, and it could be too, based on who it assimilates. It'll know. You know, it's gonna. I'm assuming it understands, obviously, since it can speak normal when it's taken over. That maybe it has the thoughts and memories too, because it can still act and answer questions as if it knew something anyway.
Yeah.
So I would assume that it would hit the US first.
Perfect or, copy.
Especially if it got a hold of Mac, which is why
all maybe it has to do is go to Florida. I think after this year, that's we've all know that that's all it needs to do. Okay. So like at this point, we see Blair grab a gun. MacReady's investigating the dirty underpants. And I'm pretty sure that it's, like I said, a pair of long johns. The team moves the bodies into the storeroom out of the lab. Fuchs pulls Mac outside for a private chat. Windows is suggesting that they burn the bodies and that it's too bad that nobody listens, like from my point of view, because we see then those bodies start to move under the blankets, not quite as dead as everybody thought before leaving the room. And I think these are actually I don't know if these are the bodies of the dogs or the body that came from the camp, the Norwegian camp, because we don't ever see it. We just know that it's like under the blankets. So meanwhile, like outside, Fuchs is talking to Mac and telling him that Blair is like cracking up, like he's locked himself in his room. And like all the he clues him in to the creature's like process of assimilation and that the remains aren't dead yet. So like because these are the notes that he found in Blair's like office or whatever. And so what is confusing to me is like, OK, Blair, you found out all this information. I think the reason that he doesn't tell the crew is rather than alarm him so they all try to escape, he's trying to keep them all there. And he thinks it's better that everyone just dies rather than this thing escaping.
Oh, 100%. That's what he's thinking. Yeah, like he immediately goes into.
So he kept it a secret to himself, and that's why he locked himself in the base.
But
then
out.
At the same time, I think he's terrified of being assimilated.
Well, and he's got that. I think he since he's you know.
I think he locked himself up so he if he were to be assimilated, that he's the last one because he wants the opportunity to kill it or like sabotage stuff and ensure that it can't escape before that happens.
He's definitely hoping everybody dies before it can get out because obviously he doesn't want to see the world just completely destroyed.
Like immediately that's his reaction. This is the only option. We all have to die. Yeah.
Which by the way, that I just checked that amount of hours would be 3 years, which really isn't that long of a time, which probably would be faster than that nowadays, but 3 years to destroy the world if it got out. So he's freaking out about it. And this is where I think everybody's like, this is kind of where the mass hysteria of everybody starts.
A little bit. Because, well, at this point, Windows walks back into the storeroom into a mess of strawberry jelly everywhere, all over the place. Bennings is being assimilated in the corner of the storeroom by the creature, wrapped up in tentacles, and we get kill number 5. Like, while the sled dog assimilation scene was pretty awesome and the first introduction to the thing, this tentacle party going on is like something else. Like, Windows, he makes a mad dash out of the room, grabbing Mac and Fuchs before they can enact their plan to get a handle on the Blair situation. So, like, that goes to shit, right? And then Bennings' thing escapes out the storeroom window into the night with Mac and the team in hot pursuit. And this is actually one of my favorite scenes with the entire team standing outside around Bennings' thing, outside in the cold as it lets out this like otherworldly alien scream into the night before Mac like dumps a barrel of gasoline all around it and sets it on fire with a flare. And the entire team is just looking on in absolute disbelief and horror again, just like staring like, oh my God. But they know that it's a thing at this point. They see that the thing hand and then Bennings' face and it didn't finish its assimilation yet. Like, it's pretty fucking cool. So Mac and Gary, they head back inside. Mac's explaining that Bennings had been assimilated. The team grabs all the gas and flamethrowers to burn the rest of the bodies in an attempt to stop the spread of the infection. At this point, other members of the team had already been infected. So we know that they're not sure, but like we're pretty sure as an audience, I think at this point, especially with Blair's like video game assimilation thing.
Yeah, so, his calculations that he punched in.
Yes. and like Blair's still hiding out at this point, so we don't know where he is or what's happening. But then Mac spots him outside sabotaging the helicopter. And then Blair, he's not insane, but he's trying to stop the spread of the contagion. And he's already willing to sacrifice the team to ensure the survival of the human race. That makes sense. Himself.
Yeah, he doesn't want it to get to land.
Exactly. So Blair is having a total fit at this point in the radio room with an axe. And the team is finally able to subdue him, but not after he's like cut them off from all manner of communication with the outside world and ways to get off the base. Yeah. So they lock Blair up in the tool shed outside, which I'm just they leave him. He's got like a jacket, but it seems like it would be really fucking cold out there.
Oh, especially later when Matt comes back.
Yeah. Yeah.
He's like,
geez,
dude.
I want to come back in now. So the team thinks up like this blood serum test to find out who's still human because they have the crew's blood stored outside. But of course, soon after that, someone goes and destroys all of the blood on the base because someone's infected and either overheard the conversation or something like that. So only Gary and Copper have access to the blood. So everyone is pointing the finger at Gary, who has the key. Tensions are super high. Gary recommends that they put Norris in charge, but he's not up to it. At this point, Norris has been assimilated. So I'm fucking positive. So Childs volunteers, but Clark objects and pulls a knife on him. Mac recommends that someone more even-tempered take over. Yeah. And Mac takes Clark's knife and Gary's gun. At this point, they don't actually ever come to an agreement on who's in charge, but we'll just assume it's Mac.
Mac's in charge.
So the team heads outside and they burn all the bags of blood. And then like Mac launches into one of the best speeches of all time.
I know I'm human. Some of you are still human. This thing doesn't want to show itself. It wants to hide inside an imitation. It'll fight if it has to, but it's vulnerable out in the open. If it takes us over, then it has no more enemies. Nobody left to kill it. And then it's one.
So yeah, Mac separates the team into groups. He moves Doc, Gary, and Clark to the rec room. I think assuming that one of the three of them has to be infected.
Well, yeah, because I think the notion that we all have already about Clark, because he was around the dogs,
right.
Dogs are his.
Well, and I'm pretty sure if I recall when they put Blair into the shed, he says to watch Clark.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. True.
Because he had that assumption when the sled dog was like roaming around all day. So they drug them. They give them like morphine or something like that. And Fuchs works on a new test. So Mac makes a tape about what's happening and decides he's going to hide it. So
hammered.
That. Yeah, he's like he's super fucking drunk at this point with that J&B. he decides like, I think he's going to hide it. If everyone dies, like someone can find it one day and know what happened here.
Destroyed.
And he's like, yeah, he's 100% drunk. I actually made a note. He's 100% drunk. That was my note.
You pretty quickly can just be like, okay, he's hammered.
He notes that nobody trusts anybody and they're all very tired. So, and you can just hear it and see it. But then things get spooky. Fuchs is working and his light goes out in his office. Like the light goes out all over camp. He lights a candle that he pulls like out of his desk or whatever and starts wandering around in the dark. And this like figure passes in front of him. Scared, he calls out into the darkness like, who's that? And he runs outside and he lights a flare and he finds a bunch of torn up clothes that belong to MacReady. Which I think is a clever trick because obviously the thing is smart and he's trying to throw them off a scent.
Right.
But then this is kind of weird to me because then I feel like they had this great buildup moment. Fuchs finds these clothes and I think it's meant to misdirect the audience, not Fuchs, because the next thing you know, Fuchs has been missing for over an hour and he's dead.
Yeah.
The clothes had no effect until later on in the film. So like they find Fuchs's body.
But. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Well, no. I mean, you go ahead.
I think you're getting to that point, though, with Fuchs' body. So,
Fuchs is missing. The team goes out to search for him. I love this scene outside in the snowstorm with the flares because it looks really, really cool.
Yeah.
When they're like walking out and they're trying to search. Mac and team head to the tool shed. They check on Blair. Blair's eating food from a can with a noose hanging nearby. Yeah. That he's tied. And Blair just goes on and on about wanting to come back inside.
He's good.
And then they find a body in the snow, and Fuchs, his body has been burned with a flare, and seemingly he's killed himself before the creature could infect him. So meanwhile, Mac notices that there's a light on in his shack, and he sends Windows inside to tell the others about Fuchs, and then he takes Knowles to investigate. So what were you getting to?
Well, it was that fact of that Fuchs burned himself alive, which I mean,
yeah, which I thought
so
it was
many questions on like what the hell happened out there with him.
Right, exactly. What happened?
Especially for, because it's literally right after he finds MacReady's clothes. So, I don't know. It's just weird. And then the light on, the lights on at MacReady's shack, which he swears he didn't leave on when he left. But who knows if that was true. But, yeah, it just brings on some questions of what the heck happened with Fuchs when he went outside. I guess there's some clear assumptions that you could have with it, but yeah, the fact that he burned himself alive is kind of interesting towards the film, like where it's going.
Well, and I'm pretty sure Carpenter's trying to misdirect us as an audience, like, oh, we found up torn up clothes that belong to Mac. Mac's lights on, he swears he didn't leave it on. Him and Knowles are now going to go alone to his shack. Well, he sends Windows inside. And then the next thing we know, Mac and Knowles are gone for over 45 minutes. So we as the audience assume.
So one of them, Mac, at least.
Like Mac has either Mac or Knowles has been assimilated and is assimilating the other one. Mm-hmm. So the team starts securing the doors, but Knowles comes back to inform the crew that he cut Mac loose from the line because he found up his... He found his torn up clothing in the furnace, and it's the same shirt that Fuchs found.
Yeah.
So that makes no sense.
Well, that's like, kind of that's where all the questions come from. Well, what the hell happened to Fuchs?
So that would mean either Fuchs ran into Mac and Mac went and put the shirt upstairs in the furnace, or like the other thing running around the base, you know, is trying to misdirect us. And Carpenter's trying to misdirect us. And I think... It makes sense why he's trying to misdirect us, because I think for some of us, me and you probably at this point, we're too smart for this shit. So we're just like, yeah, it's all misdirection. Yeah. So now everyone's like convinced that Mac is the thing. So and then we see Mac. He's like making his way back. He has to climb through a window because people aren't letting him in. Childs breaks down the door to the supply room.
He managed to lock it.
Yeah, he managed to lock it. He climbed through the window. And then with a flare and a giant bundle of dynamite, ready to blow himself up in the entire camp. If anyone comes near him, like Mac is just there. And now if Mac was a thing, Mac would not...
Wouldn't have done
be ready that. To blow himself up, because the thing's sole purpose is to survive. So yeah, right. Like he would, like, period, the thing would not.
The earlier tidbit you put in about one of the theories that Mac was one of the earlier ones to get infected. It's like, well, yeah.
It trumps the theory at that point.
Because that was my thought, because you do think for a moment that, well, maybe.
Well, it's the only time that I believe it could have happened. Mm-hmm. Yet
he does
later
that.
Mac passes the blood test.
That too. But that's, you know, you never know with that.
I think we do know with that, because so at this point, this is where Norris has his little heart attack. During the scuffle that ensues. And that's kill number 6. And then this is one of the most memorable special effects scenes in the film.
This
for
is
a lot of fans.
The coolest thing. Yeah.
They lay Norris out on the table while attempting to resuscitate him. And Norris, which we come to find out is actually Norris' thing.
Yeah.
Doc is killed when both of his arms are amputated by the thing.
Right. He's trying to bring him back, giving him CPR.
Yeah, he's using the paddles on him, and he goes clear, and then it's like, and it's like he gets his arm bit off.
Either.
You're not expecting it at all. And even every time I see it, I'm just like, wow.
Yeah, because you legitimately, who thinks of that? Like, oh yeah, this is what's going to happen. he's just going to drop right in and have his arm spit off. You know, it was, and the following bit of this too is visually, it's like, wow, what the heck is going on?
It's so good. And so this is Kill 7. And in order to pull this off, the special makeup effects designer, Rob Botten, who I've mentioned a couple times, found a man who had lost both of his arms below the elbow in an industrial accident. Botten fitted the man with two prosthetic forearms consisting of wax bones, rubber veins, and jello. Yes, jello. Like the jello you make at home. Then for the wide angle shot, he fit the man with a skin-like mask taken from a mold of Copper's face. A la like Hannibal Lecter, and placed the arms into the chest cavity where a set of mechanical jaws clamped down on them. And then as the actor pulled his arms away, the jello arms severed below the elbows. So the rest is practical effects history. And that's actually a quote from James Menzies from Mental Floss. So I found out that fun fact and tidbit.
That's interesting to find out how it was done too, because I don't know. It's such a crazy looking scene.
It's really, really cool. And so to the horror of the entire team in the room, Norris Thing with spider legs and a head like a snake and scorpion combined erupts from the body of Norris.
Yeah.
Goo literally everywhere as it howls at them. I just love all the creature howls and screams and stuff are so horrifying, and they're so unique because I've never heard another sound quite like them.
Yeah, they have a pitch that you don't want to hear. Like it's
very alien, and yeah. you expect it to be like, this is what an alien sounds like,
right? Yeah.
So luckily Mac is there to light it on fire as it screams, and then Norris's head rips away from the body and onto the floor, and then it pulls itself away as all this commotion is happening with the fire, with a tentacle tongue as more spider legs erupt from the head and it crawls away, which I'm just like, okay, so that's like really scary. I am anti-spider, as most people know. So but the team like puts the fire out unaware that the spider Norris Thing is crawling around on the floor until Palmer notices it skitter away into the hallway and Mac just like lights it on fire. And finally, we get this like awesome blood test scene that we finally come to. So I just love, I think Palmer turns around and is like, what the fuck is that? You just see this Norris spider thing on the floor. So it's interesting because this other theory that came up is that each thing is completely survival of the fittest for itself. And each thing doesn't even really, once it's assimilated itself, like it will protect itself, but it doesn't. It only thinks about itself. It doesn't think about the other things in the room. Like you might be a thing and you would kill another thing because you're not concerned about that thing. You're concerned about you.
You want to be the one to, because it's all based on particles of it, which is so interesting.
So it's like a whole nother, it was like this whole other thing where it's like, yes, but once you've assimilated this other, like, and made a copy or imitation, like you are now that entity, and you only care about survival as that entity.
Yeah.
So like Palmer at that point is only somewhat aware of the fact that he's a thing. I don't know. It was really, it gets kind of muddled, but that's, I'm sure there's good reasons. They all turned around at the same time and saw it, but only Palmer said something.
Right. He's the one that kind of started looking first is the way I saw it.
So Mac instructs everyone to tie themselves down to the couch and to each other. So he's got an idea for another blood test. What he doesn't know is that Clark has picked up a scalpel from the other room and is ready to kill him at this point. So Clark attacks Mac, and Clark unfortunately gets shot and killed on the spot. He's shot in the head. Apparently Mac was a sharpshooter at one point in time. I don't know if that cowboy hat would have indicated that to anybody, but he does have one on. We always assumed he was the first one assimilated, but he'd been human the whole time.
Well, and he wouldn't want to kill. See, and that kind of brings back the Palmer thing though. In my mind, if MacReady was one, he wouldn't want to kill one, you know, like that's what seems so weird. but I guess too.
However, with this other, that alternate theory I was just telling you about, like, they may not care.
You think that, yeah.
Yeah, so the dead bodies, again, are all tied up and put together on the table in the rec room, while the others are tied up on the couch. So at this point, Mac proves that he's human. So we're going to play a great clip from the blood test.
You tie up Palmer over here. We're going to draw a little bit of everybody's blood. We're going to find out who's the thing. Watching Norris in there gave me the idea that maybe every part of him was a whole. Every little piece was an individual animal with a built-in desire to protect its own life. You see, when a man bleeds, it's just tissue. The blood from one of you things won't obey when it's attacked. It'll try and survive. Crawl away from a hot needle, say. Now I'll show you what I already know.
It's a crock of shit.
Let's try the Doc and Clark. Now, Clark.
And Clark was human, huh? Which makes you a murderer, don't it?
Palmer now.
This is pure nonsense. Doesn't prove a thing.
I thought you'd feel that way, Gary. You were the only one that could have got to that blood. We'll do you last.
Get away from me! Retreating! What is it?
You're totally set up to believe that the thing is going to be Gary, because that's where the tension's pointing you. But all of a sudden, Palmer starts twitching, and here's the rest of the human team strapped to a couch with him, like, bouncing up and down and getting away and trying to get away and, like, screaming and just, like, because he's Everybody been attacked, like, he just, like, blood coming out of his eyeballs and he's getting all crazy and stuff. And then, and this is kill number 8. Like, Palmer thing escapes the rope and literally eats windows before he can light it on fire. And that's kill number 9. Yeah. So meanwhile, Childs, Gary, and Nalls are still yelling and stuck together on the couch. And Mac finally lights Palmer thing on fire. And I think actually throws a stick of dynamite at him out the window. And he blows up into a million pieces.
Yeah, he goes outside out the in the snow. The Palmer one, Palmer thing, I guess. goes out the door wall on fire, and then he just hucks some dynamite at it.
And then Mac comes back in and has to burn windows as he starts to turn before they finish the blood test.
So it doesn't even have to be windows. At that point, like, full digestion then.
Because it's like because of that one.
Yeah.
Think of it like a werewolf bite or something.
Because, like, he only had his head in there, and his head was like when he gets flung
out. He was covered in blood, though.
Well, and it looks like also that more some of that digestive stuff, too. If you look at his head, it's like
blood
in that. So
pretty gross. So I think everyone is accounted for as being human. Except for Blair, who we assume is still in the tool shed at this point. Mac and team, obviously, they head out to give Blair the blood test, and Childs is instructed to burn Blair if he returns. So at this point, the tool shed door is wide open. Blair has escaped through some loose floorboards in the tool shed. Blair has been assimilated, and Blair Thing is on the loose. So that's kill number 10. So at some point, one of the things was out there and killed Blair. So the team goes into the hole under the shed to find like a small spacecraft that Blair has been building underground, apparently. Childs is seen running outside the camp as the lights go out, which is really odd. And Mac plans to warm things up to prevent the thing from freezing until the rescue team arrives, because we assume the reason the generator has been damaged is so that it can like freeze and go back into the ice. That's like the whole master plan at this point, because it can't escape because Blair sabotaged all the ways to escape. So they blow up the spaceship with dynamite, and then they plow in the base and light fires wherever they can, and they are like getting ready to, like, for the most part, they're blowing up as much of the base as they can. They're lighting it all on fire. And then they know that they probably won't make it out alive, but they're pretty determined not to let the thing make it to civilization either. At this point, they've all banded together in this decision to,
Blair decision
to not survive. For the greater good. Blair Thing steals the camp generator, and the team separates to plant charges and bring the camp down into the ice, which I'm like, wouldn't that be counterproductive if you don't want it to freeze? Like, but okay, guys, I don't know. While separated, Blair Thing attacks Gary on screen, putting his fingers right through Gary's face, and we get kill number 11. So Gary, I don't think if he gets suffocated in that moment, but literally his fingers are like in Gary's face.
Yeah,
it goes into his cheeks and stuff.
I swear they had to use crazy. Like balloon material or something for that. It just looks gnarly the way
it's really cool.
Yeah.
And then it then kills and assimilates Nalls off screen, which we think Nalls deserved better.
He made it a long time, though.
The version in the film, the final film, has Nalls follow noises into the old storage room, and he then disappears. But it turns out working pretty well by adding like high tension to the climax and the mystery. But one setup for the film was for Nalls to encounter what has been called the box monster, or the Blair Thing box monster. As the Blair Thing goes through the initial stages of transformation, it was supposed to pop up and grab Nalls just as Nalls spots the twitching body of Gary around the corner. So that was what the initial plan for the scene was, but they thought it was higher tension to just have Nalls disappear and be assimilated off screen. So I still feel like Nalls deserved better. I would have liked to actually see him die and get assimilated. But yeah, so that would be kill number 12. So Mac realizes that he's alone now, lights a stick of dynamite, but drops it as the thing from beneath the ground knocks him back. Like it goes, it moves around like literally it's a scene out of Tremors.
Right.
We used to watch that a lot when we were kids.
Good old Kevin Bacon.
We did. Yeah, we watched that a lot. So it was just like a scene out of Tremors, like all the floorboards go flying up in the air. And then all of a sudden you see the new Blair Thing emerge, bigger, slimier, and like better than ever from the ground, with all of its victims emerging from it. Like Mac rolls away and grabs the stick of lit dynamite, yelling, "Yeah, fuck you too," as the thing screams. And there's like this dramatic chain of explosions that gets set off and destroy the entire base at this point. Like a lot of explosions. There's lots of fire. So in this scene, I read that Russell threw an actual stick of dynamite during this scene. Really? And that he did not, however, anticipate it being so powerful. So when you see Russell getting blown backwards, he actually gets blown backwards after the device is detonated. And the take was left in the film.
Wow.
Back so, yeah, when you almost died. That time you almost died. Yeah, he was lighting a stick of dynamite. Mac, whiskey in hand at this point, wrapped in a blanket, he finds this place to sit down in the wreckage as Childs emerges from the darkness. The men talk, not knowing if the other is infected, and share a drink as the camp burns down around them. Roll credits, the end. Carpenter, he still insists that he doesn't know which MacReady or Childs is really the thing at the end, and that's the way that we like it. So,
yeah.
Now, there are theories, though. There are theories because the thing, there are theories from people, the thing, when it assimilates you, can only assimilate biological material, and you can see when you look at Childs that he is wearing an earring the final scene, so he is not a thing. As far as Mac, we have no idea. But he did just spend all that time blowing up the thing, so we don't know. I don't think either of them are a thing at the end.
I honestly don't think Mac.
Well, Childs can't be because he has an earring and a gold tooth. And the thing can't assimilate non-biological material and imitate it. So there, it wouldn't be possible for Childs to have an earring. And you don't actually know that until you watch the prequel, where they talk about how at the end, there's a character who, the reason she knows that he's a thing at that point is because his earring is missing.
Interesting. Because I still have yet to see the prequel. The
yeah, watch. Give it a watch at this point. It'll yeah, be like watch it through a whole nother lens, too. You know what? And let me see. I think I bought it. I can share it with you. So there is an alternate ending to the thing where John Carpenter and editor Todd Ramsey shot an alternate cut, but they never used it. So Ramsey was concerned that the bleak and ambiguous ending would not test well with audiences. So he suggested that Carpenter cover his bases and have a separate spare ending ready to go. So they filmed an additional scene where lead character MacReady is rescued and appears in a room where he is given a blood test to determine whether he has been assimilated, which he passes. Fortunately for fans of the film, this alternate finale was not needed, as Carpenter stood firmly behind the movie he had made, ambiguous ending and all. So I do think that the current ending is very good the way that it is. And having it all wrapped up in a perfect little bow like that really would have just kind of fallen flat. Like, it's so much more interesting to imagine what would have what happened to MacReady and Childs. Like, we have no idea.
Well, I can almost guarantee that too, if it did well in the box office, that it would have, we would have found out, they would have made two or three more, or two.
Oh yeah,
more,
totally. Like it, whereas there's some very interesting notes that I have for you about this. So assimilation. So this came from What Culture Horror, which is like one of my favorite YouTube channels. So this is their theory on how assimilation happened. So and the order in which it happened. So Vance Norris, the silhouette whose room the sled dog enters at the beginning of the film, the producer Stuart Cohen stated the silhouette was originally intended to be Palmer, but according to What Culture Horror, Norris is patient zero in the film. Palmer is the second person to be assimilated. Dirty ripped up underpants are your clue. We don't find out about Palmer until the blood test scene, which is pretty perfect. So these are two people that they've been infected that whole time. You don't find out about them until after Bennings. So the whole thing, like, so Bennings was the third person to be assimilated. And then we actually see this assimilation occur on screen, and it's super gnarly. Blair was actually the fourth person to be assimilated. He's like the guiding force of reason in the film until his rapid descent kind of into madness, or at least what everyone thinks is madness. Because his research, yeah.
Yeah, he hits 100 real quick, though, too. So.
He does. His research informs the team of how the thing assimilates its victims and about, you know, what would happen if the creature makes it to civilization, which is super spooky. And he could have been infected during his self-imposed isolation or during the post, like, sled dog assimilation autopsy. Like, there's a couple ideas of how it would have happened, but I think it just happened out in the shed or something.
It would have had,
because it happens pretty quick.
Because yeah, so. If you think about his actions prior, when he's freaking out, or when you immediately see like his mass hysteria of the fact that, well, this isn't good, I can't let this get away. You know, I feel like that's like he's already at that point not assimilated yet. It was probably out in the shed.
Yeah, and we don't, so Blair gets put in the shed like pretty early on. We don't know at what point he escaped through the floorboards. So our assumption is Blair's assimilated. He is the one that tries to murder Fuchs, and Fuchs burns himself alive instead.
Well, that's another, yeah.
Yeah, like it's totally okay, plausible.
That is plausible.
And then at this point, Copper and Clark both die, right? Clark dies when MacReady shoots him, but first Copper dies when, you know, he's eaten by Norris thing. His arms get ripped off. Windows, Gary, and Nalls. So Windows has his head munched on by the thing. Gary is force-fed the thing's hand in the form of Blair, which is a really cool visual effects scene. And then Nalls is killed off screen by the creature. And then Childs, we assume that Childs was assimilated based on his behavior in the end of the film. However, because of the jewelry, I think he was human. And then MacReady, it's unlikely that he was ever assimilated. So,
I could see that whole layout.
Yeah. And at this point, we get a kill count of 12.
It's not bad. It's respectable.
Obviously, the anchor point in the film is R.J. MacReady, played by Kurt Russell. Kurt Russell did at least 3 different films with John Carpenter, because he did Escape from L.A. And then there's another one that he did. It's just escaping me right now.
How old was he?
I'd have to look it up. I don't know how old Kurt Russell was when The Thing came out.
I'm curious about that. Like,
we can Google it.
Because Botten was so young that it's, you know, and
Botten was very young, yeah. I know it, the thing itself, like, it didn't spend time on, how old was he?
He was 30.
He's 30 years old.
Yeah, I was surprised by that.
Yeah. He still looks exactly the same to me.
Oh yeah.
I mean, he's a little older, he's a little gruffer, but yeah, like he could totally still be R.J. MacReady right now. But like I was saying, the thing didn't spend time on exposition to establish like backstories for every character to the audience, but instead it brought us directly into their already established relationships, which I thought was interesting. Like, yeah, I actually think it was better. Like, we spent so much more time just focusing on the tension. And this lended to the realism of the film. And perhaps that's why it's still so scary and like well-liked today, because instead it made the characters and their situation more relatable by heightening the terrifying aspects of the film. There were some interesting parallels to the AIDS epidemic going on at the time, and the pandemonium and the fear of the time being unable to know who was infected by the alien creature. The feeling of paranoia and fear that existed at the time is mirrored by the characters in the film. So this is likely something that hit uncomfortably close to home for audiences in 1982. So that was kind of a parallel that I drew based on just kind of things that were going on in the 80s at that period of time.
Right.
So especially with that, you know, the unknown and the fear and things like that, because I wanted to draw like what else was going on at the time that maybe Carpenter could have drawn from. It's probably total BS. Maybe he didn't think about that, but I would love to know. So because I do think that's an interesting parallel, but he didn't play into any of the other, you know, pandemonium at the time. So yeah. But it was also, I think, sort of, and don't quote me on this, but the start of that pandemonium and the start of the epidemic, or more people kind of becoming aware of it. So it probably wasn't as well known at the time either. So don't quote me on it, like I said. But So Carpenter, he really expertly built tension and terror with his attention to detail on the thing. And the film is not simply jumping from one gore-filled scene to the next, as argued by critics at the time, but capitalizing on the emotions conveyed by each character that's fighting to survive. Like, while there are moments when we just seem to see all of them just like staring in shock at everything, like there are a lot of moments where they just look afraid. You know, like maybe they're not screaming. They're not reacting like how you might expect them to in a slasher film.
Right. Where everybody's kind of freaking out.
Which was what was really popular at the time. So I think maybe that's another reason that it was kind of confusing to audiences, is that like you expect them to be screaming, but you do get to a point where the characters do slowly become very hysterical.
Yeah. Because that's kind of what I was pointing out at the beginning of the movie, is that you're, like, for me, rewatching it now, it's like going through the intro, it's just like, what the heck is going on here? And then you've got where the Norwegian encounters the Americans and just starts shooting it, and no one's freaking out.
They keep their composure for a very long time.
Find a spaceship. No one's freaking out yet. Find some weird. Yeah,
there's an alien body. Spaceship. Nobody no seems to blink out. Too many eyes. I mean, Childs does like make a bit of a scene with like, this is a fucking spaceship. It's been here forever or whatever. Like, but nobody knows this except them, except that group of people. Like, so yeah, it's like, how would you react in that scenario? But the film began to find its audience after releases to television and VHS in 1992. So it didn't even gain popularity until like 10 years later.
Which, you know, I don't know. There's quite a few movies out there, though, that are like that, where initial release, it was not received well. But, you know, 20 years down the line, it's got a massive following.
Mm-hmm. And then Rob Bottin, like we said, he worked for 7 days a week for a year. Was actually a year to bring the creature from the film to life using animatronics, puppets, and prosthetics. It was his idea to have the alien creature constantly changing its shape.
I'm pretty sure I read too that it took them far less time to film it than it, like, I swear I read like 12 weeks to film.
The special effects were what made it take a really long time to film.
Well, the actual filming time was only 12 weeks. Where all of his effect stuff was like 57 weeks. That is a long time.
And the film's original tagline, which at some point they changed, was man is the warmest place to hide.
That's probably good they changed that one.
So something that I like to do, or we like to do on Slay Away, is rate a film with bloody knives. You have 5 out of 5 bloody knives. For me, this film is like a bit, you know, it's a big deal for me. Every time I go back to it, I love the film. Even that slow building tension at the beginning, it's the more times I watch it, the more I appreciate it. So I am going to give it 5 out of 5. And that's not a bloody knife rating that I give to many films. So, surprisingly, I don't think I even gave that one to Halloween. So,
come on. Like, I mean, come on.
I think I gave it like a 4.5 out of 5. So, but like, I think part of it is the special effects alone. And the practical effects, are just like really incredible. And, you could say that maybe there needs to be more going on with the characters and things like that, but I think it deserves a 5 out of 5. It's a classic.
I mean, I don't know. Like, I would like to give it a high rating, but it's only if I'm judging it based on the effects they used in it, because the effects were amazing. I mean, I feel like the effects,
so you can judge it on you can judge it on special effects, mm-hmm. acting,
okay,
gore, atmosphere. And like screenplay. So overall, like dialogue and stuff like that.
I feel like to like all the categories prior to screenplay, I would give it like a 4.5.
Okay. So you're rolling the 4.5 on this.
Yeah.
I think that's fair.
I mean, screenplay drops it down a good, until, like I said, though, like once it hit like that hour mark, that's kind of where, you know, I sit up a little bit more and be like, whoa, what the heck's going on here? But it's definitely a good movie. I think everybody should watch this for sure. I mean,
well, I think that there's this interesting thing that goes on in this film where there's a lot of There's like this, it's like an art where there's a use of negative space. There's a use of no dialogue. It's just either in some cases there isn't even like music or there's a very little music. There's things happening and it's light exchanges. That's why you really have to watch and pay attention, because there is a lot going on. You just have to watch for it, or there's glances and different things. Like, it's not all just dialogue. And that's what's really interesting. So I think that it uses this lack of audio space, we'll call it, where it's just different things happening on film. So,
well, and the question for you would be, do you think if they remade it now, what they like, not the prequel, but they remade 1982, would it be better with like current age CGI usage?
No. No way.
And I would agree with that too. I mean, I think what I've, I mean, growing up with horror since, I don't know, like what, 5 years old or something like that.
Yeah.
I feel like the, my appreciation for practical effects, that's why, God, what year did the new Evil Dead come out? I think it was 2011, 2012, something like that. Maybe 15 even. Yeah, and it was I was so much more excited about the movie, other than the fact that I love Evil Dead, was just that when I found out that they were going to go with primarily completely just practical effects, and they did touch-ups with CGI, so it wasn't anything major. Because there's something about, I maybe it's growing up with horror in the, in the 80s.
I thought the remake of Evil Dead was great. Yep. They did a great job. There were some slight differences, right?
Yep.
But it was very well done. And I'm always skeptical going into anything that is like a remake of a classic that I really, really like.
You got to have faith if Bruce Campbell is attached to it, okay?
Because he's got to have faith.
He's amazing. So if Bruce Campbell is attached to it.
So is John Carpenter.
Oh, absolutely.
John Carpenter is, he recently celebrated a birthday last month, I want to say, or earlier this month. So happy belated birthday, John Carpenter. And thank you for making The Thing, because we both really, really love it. So, yeah, definitely go watch the prequel. If you haven't seen A Thing from The Thing from Another World, that's the 1951 film. Don't compare them. Like, watch it as its own independent film. I thought it was fantastic. Staker, thank you for being with me today and talking about The Thing. I appreciate it. Do you have any more thoughts about the film before we go?
No, not really. If you definitely should watch it. You definitely need to get to, I think it's like an hour and 15 when Vance is turned into whatever.
I think for me, you only have to jump like 40 minutes ahead if you
get
to the part where Blair is watching the picture pages of assimilation. Thank you so much. I'm excited for everyone to hear it and listen. And thanks for joining me. And everybody, will catch you next time. Thanks. Did you enjoy that episode? If you like the podcast, we encourage you to head over to Podchaser and leave us a review. The best part is, it helps put Slay Away in the hands of more horror fans.